Today is August 8th, 2018, and this is episode number 474 of the Apple Context Machine, a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Jeff Gamet, managing editor at TMO.
And I'm Brian Chaffin, Queen Honeybee of Honeybee Industries. At least I think that's how that works.
That's so sweet.
I'm not really sure. I think that's how that works. To get the full story on anything we cover in the podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can join us over at thefacebook.com. Actually, it's just facebook.com/groups/contextmachine. And we have guests with us today.
We do. John Keat, it's so great to have you with us.
Oh, that guy?
Well,
come on.
Okay,
really?
It's part of his work release program.
Oh, yeah.
So we kind of had to.
Thanks. This is my community service burden for the day.
Yes. And I'm glad that they didn't force you to do anything worse than this.
Yeah, it's us. They did the forcing. I'm kidding. It's good to have you on the show, John.
Thanks, guys. It's good to be here.
You know, it seems like we could have a, it seems like we have some topics, at least a couple of them that you're going to find interesting.
Yeah. Before we hit any of that stuff, I want to let everyone know we have a sponsor today, Simple Contacts. It's like contacts for your eyeballs. It's awesome.
For your eyeballs?
Yeah.
Contact lenses. Oh, that's great.
Simple Contacts.
That's cool. Can't wait to find out more.
Yeah. Now there's anticipation.
I'm sorry. There's. Let's try this again. There's what?
Anticipation.
Much better. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. All right. So topic one today was sparked by some news. West Virginia is doing something with a voting app. It's aimed at soldiers who are overseas. Jeff, didn't you say you were seeing something about research on that?
Yes. So the app, a smartphone app, so that you can fill out your ballot. And it sounds like a great idea. Some people have been doing some research into the company that's providing the software for this. It's a startup. They have $2 million backing. And people are saying that what they're finding is that all the tools that they're using are out of date. So there's like security software patches that haven't been applied. And so there's some concern about just how well this is going to work.
Was this company like based in St. Petersburg? And I don't mean Florida.
You know, I'm assuming so.
Yeah.
I didn't look to see exactly where the company's from, but
no, of course not. They're not. It's not a Russian company by any stretch of the imagination. But it's really weird to even be thinking about putting together a voting app and using any kind of outdated tools. But we didn't do that research ourselves, so we don't know that those criticisms are accurate.
But we didn't need to do the research because people on Twitter did.
Oh, excellent! All right, case closed. So I thought what would be an interesting thing to talk about, and this is one of the reasons why we get John on the show, was two things. Whether or not online voting is a thing and or should be a thing. And two, because the answer to that is clearly yes. Two, what is it going to take to actually be able to get there? We've been talking about this for a very long time. And even the online polling place are just a big pile of crap when it comes to security. So like, what is it going to take? Like where do we need to go? What infrastructure do we need? What technologies need to happen? What paradigm shifts need to happen before something like online voting or app-based voting could actually be a thing?
I think a couple things are going to happen. One will be on a more political side, which is we will have increased frustration with various groups of people feeling like they're being disenfranchised from the voting system. And so that will become a catalyst to drive a lot of this forward. But then the other thing that will happen is that we will have companies developing technologies that are more easily provable to be secure. So that they'll be doing things in a more transparent way. So we can have independent validation of the quality of the software that they're developing.
I think that, okay, let's address the first thing first. And I can't believe John hasn't yet jumped in here, but the first thing is that I think the ability to vote online is inevitable and probably a must for a healthy democracy. And I absolutely look forward to the day when it can be done, as long as it can be done securely. And that's the big question.
Yeah. And my feeling is anything that makes it easier for the public to cast a vote is a good thing, because
yes,
it's important that we all get to have our say in the process.
Yeah, I agree. And I heard John about to say something.
I think I disagree with every one of your statements,
Brian. Well, it's been great having you on the show.
And kind of Jeff. But the odd thing is, I think we actually all agree in spirit with this, which is I do not think it's inevitable. It's kind of like saying, you know, human dignity and freedom are inevitable. Now, you kind of have to fight for those things. And with regard to making voting super easy, that's an interesting question, but I think we're all going in the same direction, which is I think that electronic voting would be a very good thing if it's done well, and I think if we had intelligent leadership and people kind of enough momentum and desire by the public to do this, it could be done well. It's a doable thing. This is less difficult than landing on the moon to make this electronic voting happen. But the problem is every single implementation we've ever had, from the electronic voting machines when you actually go to vote now by Diebold to this, seem to be run by just Muppets that have no credentials, no ability to do this in the right way. And it's going to take...
And sometimes have CEOs who say things like, I'll do anything I can to get a particular party into power.
Yeah. And, you know, this is one of the few things that I think could, if presented correctly, could even be a bipartisan thing in a highly partisan world, where it's both parties, you would think would be up for this, because it's possible to create better fidelity, better security, better counting, better recounting ability. And it's a question of how to go about this. And Jeff circulated is it an XPRD? I always forget the initials, comic.
XKCD.
XKCD comic that kind of made fun of this, where, you know, the current, you know, meme among programmers is that electronic voting is a joke. It's insecure. We can't even make software that doesn't bomb all the time. You know, therefore it's impossible. And if you use the word blockchain, it's kind of like using the word Hitler in an argument. No rational discourse can happen further, in the programming world after that. And while I agree in spirit with a lot of what was said there, meaning I think the quality of programmers today is garbage compared, they're not the Bill Atkinson to Muppet ratio of programmers is veering off to basically, you know,
it's headed deep into Sesame Street is what you're saying.
The barrier to entry to programming is so low that non-geniuses can do it. And that's right. I think that at the heart of your issue.
Yeah. And so I think there's like three or four pillars that are the technical solution to getting there. And if you guys are interested, I can mention those.
Sure.
But another thing I think that's important is the bipartisanship. You know, I have to go back, unfortunately, into the 70s, but we've had difficult legal questions and how to solve them. And what used to happen is that you would really have bipartisan commissions, like on the Copyright Act of 1976, which has a lot of problems, but it also solved a lot of problems. That committee took, I think, over 10 years to kind of study and do real work, real analysis on how to do things. And by the time they got it to Congress, people just kind of, you know, rubber stamped it because everyone trusted that there was real brain power behind it. They did a good job. It wasn't perfect. There's a lot of problems with it. But again, it advanced us a lot by doing that. That kind of thing doesn't seem to happen anymore, where there's real thoughtful, good experts, where it's kind of laid out to be bipartisan and people can get behind it and solve these technical solutions, because you can't expect the public to know, does blockchain make sense here or not? You know, what kind of algorithms, what kind of digital certificates, what kind of, you need kind of real knowledgeable people in the industry to do this in a fair way and take the time that's necessary to do it. And that, you know, there needs to be some kind of ground movement there. Maybe anyway, one of the pillars I think that need to be done for voting, it can't be a private company. Absolutely cannot. It needs to be open source. It needs to be an open source movement where all the code is available all the freaking time. And there are digital certificates on the code machines that can be verified at any given time or continuously so that there's no modification that's going on. And that when bugs arise, it's completely transparent.
So like, who do you want leading it? Do you want like the world of academia leading it? Do you want the government leading it? Or do you want a, you know, ragtag collection?
It almost doesn't matter who starts it, because once it goes open source, hopefully it'll attract the right people. And I think you could see a really good model for that is Bitcoin, right? It started anonymously. We still don't know the originator who brought Bitcoin about, but there were a lot of papers, technical papers going back and forth. And there was a lot of people in groups that were working on the code and saying, well, this is a problem with encryption here and that's a problem with encryption there. And they really battered on this for quite a long time before it was launched. And it's been pretty robust. Is it perfect? No. But a lot of the bugs were broken out of it because it had sunshine on it. It had, and it attracted real professionals that know this stuff well to really focus on it. And so you could do a similar thing here with a system. It almost doesn't matter who starts it. As long as the framework of it is decent, people can add on and just make it more and more robust. But it being open is super important, that there are no back doors, it's just going to make everyone feel much more confident in any results. It doesn't mean it's going to be perfect, but that kind of scrutiny is very healthy for something like that.
So there's a couple of, the first point I want to make is that despite the fact that I'm a champion of the idea of online voting, currently I want paper ballots backing up everything, because the electronic voting that is available, as John already alluded, is just awful. So I'm not agreed. Right now we need paper ballot backups at the very least. So I'm definitely talking about some sort of, you know, pie in the sky future.
So I agree. And actually, even in the future, I think you still want a paper backup, and I would say a double paper backup. So here's another idea you could have. Diebold is a disaster. I mean, they're horrendous. In some Agreed. Of the voting machines, apparently they had not just back doors, but they had
remote access.
Remote access. I mean, like, you got to be crap. You got to be kidding me. So that's why you can't have these private companies. You really need an open source system that's just very well known. But paper, this is why it's important with paper. There will always be an issue. No software will ever be perfect, no matter how awesome, you know, the contributors are. But this is my idea. Whether you have remote, and there's two forms of electronic voting. There's the kind that you go to currently, where you go to the voting booth still, and then there's the kind of, you have it on an app. But regardless of what form, I think there should still be a hard copy. And you could see a hard copy doing a few things that make it more robust. One, there would be two copies made, one for the voter if they wanted it. They don't have to have it, but maybe we mandate it, maybe we don't. But definitely one on site, wherever the voting servers are, with each vote. And a couple of the ideas that were kind of decent with this app that they're using just for, I believe, the military that's abroad. So this is it's nice at least that they're limiting the scope. So it's not the West Virginia voting system, that it's just for, I guess, military.
It's aimed at overseas military.
So hopefully that means it's a nice smaller pool. But you're supposed to do a selfie and a video selfie as you're doing the I don't think they do it as you're doing the vote, unfortunately, here. But that would be one of the things I would do is, as you're voting, maybe you just you're doing this. And so you get a printout, and the printout will have maybe your face, a mugshot of sorts on it. It could have a couple of QR codes on it that are digital certificates of your vote. And unlike that comic that says, you know, anytime you hear the blockchain, you should be worried because it's probably some kind of scam, which is kind of true. But this is one of the few areas where that technology makes so much sense to have a vote put on the blockchain, because that vote can have a digital certificate that now, when you have the printout, you can do a check, a digital signature check, to see if it hashes correctly for your vote, for the machine, for your ID. And so all those can be a hash check, and then they could have a physical printout at the site. So when they're doing the recount, if anyone questions even the vote, like, is this a real person or whatnot, you can do a hash check. Was this the printout copy actually matching the one that was registered on the blockchain? So these kind of things can help. It'll make everyone feel better that even if the system blows up, right, at least you have a physical copy. There's nothing wrong with having the paper ballot as a backup to it. So whenever there's a question, people can go do this. And by having two forms of printouts, you can prevent also.
Or online voting, though, go to a polling place, making the paper trail you're talking about not possible, at least when you're talking about my version of online voting and or app-based voting.
Well, if you're doing it in an app, it could just generate a PDF that you could print out anytime you want on your phone. Mm-hmm. And it will literally print out the server source. There could just be a mass printer that's just printing out every vote that
comes. But who's to say that if I'm sitting in my living room voting in my underwear, mm-hmm, as one would, and then there's a paper ballot being printed out at the server, who's to say that paper ballot actually match? I mean, that's exactly
the
custodial chain.
Well, that's the beauty of it, right? It registers a hash onto the blockchain of the vote, that you get a hard copy with your face, that an ID that are hashed onto a QR code on the physical thing. If someone messed with the physical printout at the server, That's a double check, right? Now there's three different sources that have to hash match. You can even hash out the photo that's going to be saved to the PDF pixel for pixel, that has to match the hash on the blockchain. So that makes it super difficult to fake the photo, fake the hash on the printout that still has to match the blockchain entry ID that would be on that, right? And now you have the problem is that the actual voter has a backup. So if there's a question, voters can come in and say, your recount stuff is bogus, right? Here are mine. So this, by having that many kind of cross checks and balances on it, you really can enhance security. There's a possibility for super enhancing security with this. But you need experts that know this stuff.
Yeah, you do.
To implement it. But the core of it is doable, is my point. Whether or not people, the fact is that the people making this system and Diebold could have, you know, done things more securely, but they just did them in a crappy, cheap way with back doors and now all kinds of stuff. So profit. You need serious.
There's a profit motive as opposed to an integrity of the election motive.
Now, so, part of what we're doing here, we're talking about blockchain. And I'm betting there's some people that don't know what that is. So I'm going to play straight man for a second. Guys, what's blockchain?
Blockchain is a boring ledger. It's just like kind of in your checkbook when you keep a ledger of all the things that you've ever, you know, wrote checks out for. And it each entry can have a unique hash, meaning it's like a digital certificate that has a mathematical resolution that's hard to fake. But it's stored in the cloud whenever you make a transaction on the blockchain, and it's replicated amongst thousands, if not tens of thousands of machines. So if someone tries to fake that entry in one machine, it could. If someone tries to fake the entry on one machine, it will be flagged as invalid because all the other machines, it's very difficult to impossible to manipulate and fake the entries on all the machines that took the initial entry.
Yeah, and it is replicated on participating machines. It's not necessarily thousands, nor is it limited to thousands for whatever that's worth. And there are two systemic issues here. The first is, and by the way, I with what we know today, sitting here right now, blockchain, some kind of blockchain based technology is the most likely to offer a future of online voting. Okay, so but there are two things. One is the integrity of the system, which blockchain could well assist with. The problem is there's another systemic integrity issue here, and that is the integrity of my individual vote, which is that I have to keep and maintain my keys that allow me to register my vote on the blockchain. And we see this right now, even with Bitcoin, where if someone loses their keys to their Bitcoin wallet, it's gone.
So there are technical solutions to this too. And you could look at Apple Pay kind of on real-time tokenization, but they have a backing store. You could also have potentially a distributed version of this where that backing store is distributed, is not owned just by Apple, but it could be, kind of on its own distributed network, that has its own verifications. And again, I think the important thing here is this needs to be open source, one with lots of scrutiny and eyeballs, and two, with lots of good brains on it. So it's not a question of, is it doable? The question is, can we get the right people to actually do it and move it forward? Because the wrong people currently are. And I don't mean to crap on Diebold because like they're some bad, evil company. They are a bad, evil company, but it's not because, they were born that way. They just chose to be lazy and horrible at what they do.
Well, it's voting with a profit motive. It's actually really weird, by the way, to hear you talking all this communist stuff with me and agreeing with me.
We probably are disagreeing, but keep going.
Approaching a voting and trying to solve it with the private sector involving a profit motive ensures that you will get people who are prioritizing profit over something, be it convenience, be it the interface, be it the integrity and trustworthiness of the system, et cetera. Many somethings are going to be sacrificed on the altar of profit. And when it comes to voting, it's way too important to allow that to even be a remote possibility.
So this is why it needs to be open source.
We definitely disagree on that. Just because there's a profit motive doesn't necessarily mean it will be crap. Oftentimes it is. But Apple Pay from Apple has some profit motive on it, but it's still a really a good product.
It's not a public system.
Someone would say that the inventors of Bitcoin have profited probably quite a good bit, and there was some profit motive in there too. But it doesn't mean it makes the product any more denigrated. It's the quality of the people and the motives behind them. It's okay to make a profit on this too, but I agree the focus here, particularly with voting, you're right. It has to be on the good of the system for the users. That has to be front and foremost. People can make profit on this. There's no evil necessarily in that. And a lot of times that can help things. But a lot of times it just makes for I'm willing to concede that it's very clear with voting systems that the profit motive here has let everyone down. It's just produced subpar products, but it's not, we disagree that it's inherently the problem. And I gave you two systems that I think have done okay, and there's profit motive in them, and namely Bitcoin. If you think that was all altruistic, well, we disagree on that. And Apple Pay, I think there's some profit motive there, but it was designed to be as secure and good for the user as possible. So these systems are doable. It's to me, it's more of a question of.
I don't want to put Apple in. I love Apple. Mm-hmm. And I love Apple Pay, and I trust Apple to handle Apple Pay, but I don't want to put Apple in charge of voting.
I didn't say they were. I'm just saying there's a system that was had a profit motive and still
but
it's
different. But my point is that you're
and it's secure.
It's an apples and oranges comparison.
Well, so at some level, yes, and at some level, I think it still applies. Obviously, you're mod.
I accept your apology.
No, I'm not apologizing. So na.
Guys, I'm going to go make popcorn so I can keep watching this.
Yeah, right.
But I think we're mostly vehemently running past one in that I think the open source here is probably the best case just because it does deserve a lot of scrutiny and having it open and verifiable ultimately is a better mechanism for making everyone comfortable that the system isn't being manipulated.
Yeah, and it's most likely to. And I by the way, problem with companies eventually being able to make a profit from the system by, you know, developing, I don't know, like a handheld voting machine or something like that is, but the integrity of the system, I think, is going to be enhanced with some sort of open source approach to it. Voting is too important to risk otherwise.
And I think we can agree on that.
Okay, great. Again, I do accept your apologies, and
not
I appreciate it. I appreciate it very.
You very have ego issues that you need
very
that badly.
Much.
Oh, I should have poured a drink before this show.
So, I don't want to. I don't want to risk missing this. So, why don't you? Why don't you tell us a little bit about some simple context, Jeff?
Oh, I can totally do that. All right,
our sponsors.
Yeah, so first, thanks Simple Contacts for being our sponsor. Mm-hmm. Here's the deal. If you wear contacts or you want to wear contacts, it's expensive. That's just how it works. So Simple Contacts has a whole thing in place where you can order the contacts that you want and save money and get free shipping too, which is pretty awesome. But the catch is you have to have a current eye prescription. And
well, sure, you always have to have a prescription to get glasses or contacts.
Yeah. And that gets expensive. And you may have a prescription that's valid. So if you do, no problem. You can just like take a photograph of it, upload it to their system, and get the contacts that you need. No problem. But let's say your prescription has just recently expired, but you know your eyes are fine because you can still see everything just the way you did before the prescription expired. Not a problem. What you do is you still give them that prescription, but they have this whole system where you do this basic eye test thing yourself, and the information from that gets uploaded to Simple Contacts, and then they have an ophthalmologist review that test, and if the results look good to them, they'll extend your prescription for you so that it's still valid, and now you can get your contacts.
Oh, it's useful.
It's really useful, and it's a lot cheaper and takes less time than if you have to go to your eye doctor because it's $20 and you can do it at home.
Mm.
So it's a nice.
In my underwear.
In your underwear.
That's great.
I would expect nothing less. Yes.
Exactly. As you do.
Yeah. So, and seriously, the test, it takes like 5 minutes and that's it. So it's easy to do. It's inexpensive. And it can extend that prescription that you already had. And now you can get the contacts that you want. I mean, and they have gobs of brands. So if there's a brand and lens type that you prefer, odds are you can get it for them for cheaper than you can get it other places. Mm. And so because all of our listeners are here, they get to have a special deal. So if you go to simplecontacts.com/ACM, then you get $20 off your first order. And so it's nice. So save an extra $20. So that's simplecontacts.com/ACM. And if you get there and realize, ah, crap, I forgot to use the URL, but I want to save some money, no problem. You can use the special discount code ACM. See the pattern here?
I do see that.
Use the special discount code ACM at checkout, and you'll still get your $20 off your first order. So that's really cool. That URL again is simplecontacts.com/ACM. $20 off your first order. And thank you, Simple Contacts, for being our sponsor.
Yeah, super convenient. And the savings are definitely worth it. And we love the fact that they're sponsoring us. Show them some love and check them out, please.
Yes, indeed. All right. So now what do you feel like talking about, Brian?
Well, it seems like we should also mention, by the way, that this is not a replacement for a periodic full eye exam.
Oh, yes. Yes. That's a really good point. Yeah. It's you still need to go see your eye doctor because there's a lot of things that they check for that a basic eye exam to see if your prescription is still good isn't going mm-hmm. to hit. So
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Let's see. So we also have this idea here. And I don't want to get into details as to how we actually got to picking this particular topic because John Keat is a little bit nuts, but don't tell him I said that.
Yeah, my lips are sealed. He'll never know.
And instead, what I thought would be a really interesting idea is to look at the growing power of technology companies. So I'm talking, you know, Facebook, Google, Apple, Amazon, right? That's probably the four biggies at this point. Mm-hmm. In terms of this particular discussion, do you agree with that, John?
Yeah, yeah.
Would you throw anyone else into the mix? Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, they're all different. They're all different shades of the social media companies. So Snap, and I don't know, maybe some of the others, but
yeah, I don't think Snap is so. The idea is whether or not these companies are starting to blur the lines between the public square and the world of private commerce and, you know, the private world.
Sure.
And it's an interesting question to me. And this was all sparked by, Facebook and YouTube all banning to one degree or another, Alex Jones's, InfoWars.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Apple as well.
What's that?
And Apple as well.
Yeah, I mentioned them, but we'll stress that. So Apple, Facebook, and YouTube to one degree or another because they're not necessarily – Alex Jones has not necessarily gone from Apple's platform entirely, but they get rid of their podcast?
Yes.
InfoWars podcast?
Got rid of I believe there's five InfoWars podcasts that were removed. There's one more podcast that's part of the InfoWars family that doesn't involve Alex Jones. That one is still there. And then the official InfoWars app is still available for the iPhone and iPad on the App Store.
And this conversation, by the way, I don't know if you guys caught the her name is Millie Weaver. Did y'all catch this thing with her?
No.
She's a quote-unquote reporter. She's someone involved with InfoWars. And she was saying on Twitter that all the libtards out there who are saying that this isn't a free speech issue because Facebook is a private company are wrong because Facebook is a public company. Therefore, it's a First Amendment issue.
I do remember seeing that. Yeah,
that in and of itself is not well reasoned.
No, it is not.
That is not such a polite way to say that, John. Wow.
But it's interesting. I mean, that actually kind of played into why I want this, right? Like, how, you know, YouTube has so much power in the world of video and distribution, and Apple has obviously enormous power within its own ecosystem. Of course, its own ecosystem is actually a relatively small part of the overall market. Facebook is, you know, is essentially a monopoly on Facebook. And like at what point could, is it possible for private companies to become so huge, so large, you know, and Apple's worth, right? But is it possible for companies to become so big within some form of speech area, like videos or social media or something, that it starts to like any decision they make to kick someone off could become a free speech issue where it's like almost like where their power is almost synonymous with the governmental power because they are so powerful.
So the short
Am I saying this right?
So the short answer is yes. And I think you could make it a little broader and a little more to the point, which is it possible for private companies or non-government entities like a private or public company to abridge people's civil liberties? And the short answer is, of course, yes. We have laws literally written because that has and does occur, right? Our antitrust laws deal with that. There are concepts of common carriers. So the telephone company, you know, if they said you can't talk about puppies when you have phone calls, right? That would be a problem. And
there's the American with Disabilities Act, which is which addresses this, right? It holds companies.
Essential utilities are also common carriers, right? If water companies decide we don't want to give certain people water, that's life liberty, right? I mean, that's a basic civil. There's kind of these civil liberty things. Once an entity reaches a common carrier type status, the rules change. It's much like once you become a monopoly, you cannot continue to behave the way you did when you were not a monopoly because it becomes an antitrust violation. It becomes anti-competitive once you reach a certain scale and size. And some of these companies have reached that scale and size in their niche, and their niche can be wide enough that you could starts to be... deal with speech in general, and they get protections, right? The DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, has shielded YouTube and Facebook and many of these others because they're basically a common carrier. They say, look, you can't, they can't be sued for stuff that's on their site that's a copyright infringement because it's just too difficult. The police, you know, you give them a takedown notice, they'll do their thing, but otherwise they're shielded. Mm-hmm. So because they enjoy some of these common carrier benefits that the government bestows upon them, it's a very reasonable argument to articulate and say, yeah, you know, once they've gotten to a certain size and they prevent types of speech, that can be an abridgment of speech. And I think that there's no debate that it's doable and possible, and it clearly has happened that companies have abridged civil liberties. The question is, for each of these, have they attained that level that now when they do this stuff, it is an abridgment?
Yeah, well, I don't think we've had a situation in the past where a company has. Wait, maybe this is not correct. Where a company has abridged free speech by not allowing a customer to speak through them. That's never been an issue. We've had other forms of civil liberties. Infractions I'm not sure how to put that, but I don't think we've had anything in the, have we?
Yeah, I mean, the closest we get to, I think what you're going for tangentially is what's happening with China right now, where China may put pressure on Apple with regard to iMessages, that they want censorship on iMessages in China, not to have certain types of speech on it and be carriers for that speech. But that's really more government action than company action. The company is
just, well, that's the government actually reaching out through a private company to exert censorship.
But Facebook just put out its kind of terms recently, showing, you know, what is hate speech, and now you can't say, if you compare someone to an animal, that is considered to be a violation of their speech. So if you say George Bush is a monkey boy, right? That is now, you can't voice that opinion, which is silly, right? Yeah, and it shows you how difficult it is to police, to make, regardless of where you are in the political spectrum. I mean, people.
Wait a minute. So I couldn't say that someone fornicated like a rabbit? That's yeah. obviously slightly different terminology.
No, that's a comparison. If you said that they,
well, it's not derogatory, right?
probably not.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So, but yeah, if it's deemed to be derogatory, yeah.
Now,
yeah, and it shows how difficult it is to make these rules for speech. But those are the new things. But the question becomes is, well, it's okay. They're a company. They can say you can't talk at all. Right. I mean, they could just close down the service if they wanted to. So, the question is, have they reached that common carrier status? I think for Facebook, in the US at least, there aren't that many alternatives. Instagram is owned by them. Mm-hmm. Twitter is a very different type of venue, but I guess there is some overlap.
Twitter and Facebook are probably the closest.
Yeah.
To the point that you're getting to, Facebook may well be getting closer to that common carrier status, but they're probably not there yet.
So, and I think reasonable people can debate that issue. I kind of feel like they might. I think that Facebook is. I think that as much protesting as I get from millennials that they're quitting Facebook, their numbers only go up. As a matter of fact, the only Facebook posts I ever see are all from millennials, despite their protests of quitting it any day now. So there's no other real venue for a lot of folks to go to have these conversations, which are, mostly, 99% of people just talk about whatever baloney they want to talk about, just like they do in their personal lives, and it's fine. And whether people are entitled to this medium is another interesting question here. But I think that, to me, Facebook is kind of like, it depends how you define the market, right? It was the game that Microsoft played very well try to play well with its monopoly status, right? If you define what is the relevant market for software, and if you say it's all software, even stuff written for a microwave, right? Well, then Microsoft owned only 20% of all the software on Earth. If you defined it as the PC desktop, then they owned 99.9% of it. And if you defined it as all computer operating systems, it was probably more like
90.95%. Yeah.
So how you define what is the market will predetermine the outcome. And here, what is the speech? Is it what's Facebook speech versus all of speech, like in the town square in between people? All right, it's a small portion. What is it based on, kind of a forum where you have a circle of friends and social acquaintances? It's probably, in the US, I'd say it's probably over 80%, But I agree. I'm not to say that you're wrong. You may be right, and you may define that market differently. And reasonable people can disagree, but it's getting close. Is
yeah, they're probably the closest. YouTube does not status simply because there are a jillion other ways to distribute video.
I'm going to disagree with you there. Not that there's a jillion other ways to distribute video,
but they own it.
Wrong.
But the position that they're in, it is part of Google, and it is the single largest search platform for video content, and not just in the United States, around the world. So they're in a unique position in the video space because
it's not China.
So this is the question, and this is also a different way. How do you measure market share, right? If you just say, by the number of competitors, well, there are a lot of competitors. I agree with you, Brian. But by the vast majority of where videos are actually held, they probably own more than 90%.
Yeah, but there are alternatives.
But that's not that's generally not the way you measure market share, right?
No, it's not the way you measure market share, but it is how you measure market power.
Now, market power also involves market share, at least from a legal standpoint. So whether you're going to be deemed a monopoly in that has everything to do with if there are 30,000 alternatives, but 99% of the people put their videos up on YouTube, it becomes irrelevant because they own that market and they're going to have the market power for a legal definition there.
Okay, fair enough. But you also have cable. That is still a thing. You have satellite TV. Sure. That is still a thing. And I would say that those forms are actually still bigger than YouTube.
Again,
well, I still just accept your apology.
It depends on how you define that market, the relevant market for all these things for monopoly. But then the monopoly standard doesn't necessarily tie into common carrier status, right?
Correct.
So that's where I think your argument with having the more outlets actually becomes more relevant, because it's not just market power that defines common carrier status. Anyway, I think reasonable people can disagree, and it depends on what you're talking about. Like, I think if Apple did almost anything that was a little bit askance in the music industry, that's probably the one area where they might be considered dominant, not in streaming, but in, say, purchasing, right? They probably own the online, even though Amazon has it, they have a very small market share relative to Apple. That's probably where they get the closest. But in every other way, Apple is a niche player. So they could, there, anything they want, Apple could just say, screw you in anything it does, and it's not really going to be an issue with regard to common carrier status or monopolies.
But the original discussion was whether or not we could cross that line, and clearly that line could be crossed. But as it is, I don't think it is an issue yet. And the reality is that Facebook and YouTube and Apple can all decide to dismiss someone because they violated the terms of service, so that's what they want to do.
Well, with Alex Jones, it's particularly easy, because at least I found a video where he incited a mob to imminently grab a person. Direction to a mob for violence is actually, it's prohibited speech. The First Amendment does not allow you to go on and say, hey, let's go burn the witch, right? Right now, let's go burn this person or do this horrible thing of violence. That is not protected speech. It is illegal speech. You will go to jail literally for it. It is the proverbial crying fire in a theater, but you're not allowed to do that. He has videos where he literally does that. So there's zero issue on this one on a terms of service basis. Secondly, it's literally illegal speech that he was engaged in. So it's pretty straightforward. But this will get more subtle, just like we had a hard time. You know, it's kind of like the old definition of porn in the legal world. No one could define it. And, at one point, you know, a judge says, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it, is kind of the definition of it. It's the same way with hate speech and all these other things. They're very fuzzy. And this is only going to become more and more of an issue over time. And I think what will happen is, it's kind of like the phone, the cell phone in some court proceedings has recently been viewed by some judges as kind of an essential part of a person, right? And it is deserving privacy because it's just an extension of your brain in some ways. And people will disagree on whether that's true or not. But as things become more ingrained into our life, it becomes easier to for people to say, well, that's true. Right. If that argument was argued back when the flip phone was around, people would laugh at you. But now it's had time to kind of cook and stew into our psyche. And so that argument becomes, there's momentum behind that argument becoming true. And I think it's the same thing that's going to happen with Facebook and some of these social outlets, where people are going to say, this has become part of our culture. This has become part of who we are. This is a valid form of communication. And it deserves to be protected, just like talking in the town square is. And then at some point, these companies are going to have to, you know, if they're smart, in my opinion, they're going to run to common carrier status and say, I don't want to police this. Right. I don't want to be involved in this, because it's too difficult. It really is too difficult to do, because saying this person is a monkey boy in their politics is a perfectly reasonable thing to say. It's normal debate. It's colorful debate that people can have. And why is Facebook getting in the midst of this, right? And the reason is because it's so difficult to figure out, you know. So instead of just cutting out what we know it when we see it, really bad speech, they have to try to make these guidelines. And these guidelines will never work, because there will always be over-inclusive and under-inclusive all at the same time.
Yeah, but Mark Zuckerberg is not going, because he's not going to want to lose to terrible decisions.
I'm sorry, you cut out there. Mark Zuckerberg is not going to go where?
I said that Mark Zuckerberg is not going to go looking for status because he's not going to want to lose the power to make terrible decisions.
I think Jeff is literally censoring every time you say Mark was like.
It's funny because both times, Brian, you cut out. So I'm assuming what you're saying is that Mark Zuckerberg is not going to openly embrace common carrier status.
Because he doesn't want to lose the freedom to make terrible decisions.
That's really an interesting, that deserves its own rat hole of how smart and stupid people are when they have an easy out and not taking it. You may be completely right there, Brian, and I have nothing else to say to it than, yeah, he may.
He loves that power.
Yeah.
To make absolutely miserably bad decisions.
You mean like calling our bank companies after all this privacy heinousness and say, hey, can we have your banking information too? That's a brilliant decision to do now.
That was a good decision. Although you listened to yesterday's TDO, I really don't think that's how it went down.
Yeah. All right. I'm sorry. Well, I don't know the details, so I'll defer to you on that.
No, I don't know the details either. Just doesn't make any sense that would have happened. Anyway, that's
not what you're saying is when people seem to be really blatantly stupid, we shouldn't take them on face value as being as stupid as they seem.
No, I'm definitely not saying that. I'm absolutely not saying that. The very, very short version, John, is that it makes more sense that Facebook was talking to banks about being able to get hooks into people's bank accounts when the people so chose so that they could launch their own payment platform. That makes more sense than Facebook going and trying to trade for our financial data.
I see.
If they did that, Mark, what did I say, Jeff? That Mark Zuckerberg is insane and has lost all sight of reason. Something like that.
Something like that. I bet we'll have a link in the show notes so people can listen and hear it for themselves.
Yeah, fair enough. Let's do that. Okay, so we are running out of time. We're running out of time. So a brief mention, we got an email from Jason Lord. And he said, Brian, there are days I appreciate what you have to say. And there are days when it appears you'd rather hit the recreational hash pipe. Fair point. Except for the fact that I don't actually do drugs. And he also said, and this is the only part.
Metaphorical hash pipe.
Apparently, yes. And then, but he also said, this is the only part that line I just gave you and the other line, but this is the line that Jeff liked. P.S. Sorry, Jeff, you're usually so polite and non-contentious. I hope you're not offended by my comments that are directed at Brian. The ACM podcast wouldn't be the same without your good-natured disposition. It's part of the show.
And, you know, I've always been impressed with Jason. Gentleman, scholarman, so brilliant. And I think this is a fantastic comment. Thank you, Jason, for your feedback.
Yeah, the stuff in between is simply about the fact that he has a different level of trust in all corporations than I'm apparently willing to extend to Apple and to Amazon and Google. They said what I consider to be the right things. And to me, the lesson there is simply that we are, in fact, all wired differently. What were you going to say, John?
I agree with what you just said. It's fair enough. And I agree with his assessment. Jeff is incredibly, incredibly nice. I keep being floored at Jeff's consistent performance on The Daily Show as well. So kudos.
Oh, thanks.
Indeed. Fantastic. So we're running out of time. So our third topic was actually going to be Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
So, and we don't have a lot of time to explore it, but you know, let's dig in just a little bit.
I love Star Trek.
Yeah. The great thing is we can say, oh my God, Patrick Stewart is coming back to Star Trek.
Yes. I've already spent time in my bunk over there and I was, and very, very pleased. And the show is like 20 years I think after the
Nemesis. The last movie, Nemesis.
After the last movie, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
It's actually been, 26 years since the last movie?
Has it?
In real time. Oh. Yeah, in real time. Okay. But the show is supposed to be set 20 years. But when they said all this, they hadn't written a single script yet. They just have essentially an agreement in principle to develop the show.
Right.
Maybe some contracts.
And the back and forth communication that has been going on with the production team, the producers, and Patrick Stewart, they've agreed that this will be a different show.
They have said this will be a different show. Have you followed this, John?
I have. The only two pieces I was able to, I'm trying to figure out, like, what do they mean different? And Patrick Stewart alluded to, seems like they have, he wanted the freedom to be somewhat different in character and to have some growth, which makes sense after 20 some odd years. Mm-hmm. The only thing he alluded to that I read was, he kind of talked about our current dark times, right? I guess politically is my guess is what he's talking about. That's and my guess is, yeah. And so that there's probably going to be look at like the current events, but it's funny. He talks about that being different, but I view that as the same. Like Star Trek has always been about exploring the barriers of our culture and the failings and both good and the good things and the bad things of our culture and kind of putting them up on the screen to have a different perspective on them. So
to it, let that be your last battlefield. That is the ultimate demonstration of that.
Yeah. So that's what makes me a little bit confused in saying, like, well, what's different about that other than, I guess, the growth part? But whatever. I like Patrick Stewart, so I don't care. Go ahead.
My hypothesis is that what he means is that this isn't going to be as clean and sterilized as Next Generation was.
And Next Generation was very clean and sterilized.
Yes.
Here's what I would like. And okay, so first of all, I love the character of Jean-Luc Picard. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I greatly admire Patrick Stewart's acting. I think he is just like the bee's knees. Thirdly, that said, I would love it if they were like, I mean, as much as I like, just imagine if Jean-Luc Picard was broken in this series, and the series is like him, like maybe finding redemption, like, and what if he's broken because of something like he and Beverly Crusher got together and before the show started, right? 10 years before the show started, and he killed Beverly in an accident and it broke him. I mean, like, how interesting could that character be? I mean, just massively interesting to me.
What are you doing killing off people? What is this?
Oh, he's been hanging around George R. R. Martin too much.
The character of Jean-Luc Picard played by Patrick Stewart as a dark and broken character near the end of his life, or at least in the sunset of his life, could just be amazing, riveting to you. Amazing.
So I agree with everything other than wanting the cliche killing off your love, and it's just so cliche that I want to barf. But other than that completely derivative thing, I kind of agree. Like there is a lot to explore with a lot of introspection as someone gets older, right, and grittier and grimmer. But the current Star Trek, I think, one, I love it. I don't know if you guys caught up and seen season one yet, but it's
Star Trek Discovery.
Yeah, it's pretty grimy. It's pretty. It's not clean.
I like that. That's actually. Yeah, I like that. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm intending to.
I really enjoyed it.
I was shocked that I enjoyed it, and you guys know me well enough to know that there was a high chance I was going to crap all over it. And I liked it. And it make actually the only thing that makes me feel good is for some reason the general critics have really been negative on it.
That's the reason why you like it.
That is not.
You were misguided.
He likes this one because it's good.
It's really good. I was so beyond the production values, which are basically near movie level in my. Mm-hmm. I liked all the stories. I liked the twists and turns, and I didn't know that the critics panned it until I'd already finished kind of watching it. Because I for every Star Wars movie and Star Trek stuff, anytime I see anything in the media about it, I instantly flip it off because I don't want to see it.
What'd you say? Did you just say something? Do we have to delete that?
No. Flip it off.
Thank you. Very good, gentlemen. Very impressed. If the critics had spooged all over it with their love, you probably would have turned around.
You make a good point, but luckily I watched it and I gave all my comments in our group before I had seen that. So I was stuck with my comments. So you
just had to live with the fact that you enjoyed the show.
I did. Yeah, listen, I'm not going to lie to you. You know me well enough that my lie would be useless anyway.
Yes, it's true. It's absolutely true. Okay, one way or another, I can't wait. I cannot wait to see what Patrick Stewart is going to do with this. By the way, I also love the fact that, you know, like if you've ever seen him on any talk shows or, you know, someone where he's being interviewed and they want to start talking to Star Trek, and this is in particular, like, you know, in you know, after certainly after 2002, right? He would like, do we want to talk about that old stuff? You know, he did not want to talk about Star Trek,
and he felt that it was done,
right? Yeah, and he only took the job because he thought the show would be canceled.
Yeah, he seriously did not think that there would like even be a full season.
He was assured the show would be canceled.
Yeah, so, you know, it's one thing I dislike about him. I dislike about him that this is not singular to him. He doesn't realize how by poo-pooing what he did is so beloved. He made an atmosphere in that show. I don't even know how to quantify it. But when I watched that show, it created a world that kind of integrated into my world and life at the time. It was like a feeling when you go to your if you have a good relationship with your parents and you go home again and there's that homey feeling about it. It's a whole universe that he helped make real, and it's a very impressive thing to be able to do in the confines of what is a very cheap and cheesy show. And it's a bit like, I really respect, I read this interview, I think it was in Rolling Stone or something like that, it was Variety, with Billy Joel, where he said, look, I just can't write as well as I used to. And I think Bob Dylan has, you know, admitted the same thing. So he's like, so I'm going to play my old hits. And I know that the odds of me writing that kind of killer thing isn't as good. So I'm just not going to try. I'm not going to, demean myself. And it may be that in the middle of your career, you have this amazing thing, and it's nothing to be, you know, ashamed of or anything. And people are, of course, you know, that's what you're known for. So it happened in the middle, not at the end. There you are.
All right. So all that said, and we're so out of time, but all that said,
yes, we are.
I don't actually think he poo-pooed on the fans' love of the show. I don't think he ever had an issue with that. And I also don't think he had an issue with the iconic status that his character achieved. I think he just simply, when he had something new to talk about, wanted to talk about the new stuff and didn't want everybody to be living in his past when talking to him professionally. Rightly or wrongly, I can respect where he's coming from on that.
It's like going to, you know, like in concert and them saying, well, we're not going to play Hotel California. You got to expect that people are going to want to hear Hotel California. And I get, like, you might want to try to promote the newer stuff or whatever, or maybe even the majority of it. But to have this expectation of, oh God, you're asking me about that. Well, I'm like, dude, that's your big thing.
Okay. I get what you're saying. Right. Let's not go down that rat hole anymore. The real thing I wanted to mention was that, and he acknowledged that in his own, I think it was on a panel discussion where he himself said, I thought I was done with the show, acknowledging the fact that he has been publicly done with it, and saying, but they've basically, you know, come up with some ideas that I think are really interesting in ways that I had never thought of before. And I like the fact that he didn't try to pretend, you know, he didn't like try to pretend that he's always been, you know, it's like, yes, I've been wanting to revisit this character my entire career. You know, he didn't try to rewrite history. He said, yep, there's that history. I said those things. And the reality is that, you know, the new information has come to light. And I just think this is a great idea. And I respect that.
Look, having an iPod with video is a stupid idea. until it's an awesome idea.
That's right.
he was lying when he said that.
Well,
there's a difference.
Yeah, well, some people lie at all kinds of different opportune times. Anyway, Patrick Stewart, no one's saying he claimed to be a perfect human being. He's an awesome human being, though, and I enjoy his work. And so the bottom line is I'm thrilled that he's going to be doing it, and I can't wait till it happens. But my guess is it's probably 3 years away, right? Like between production and getting it set and actually out the
door. 2 years at least, right?
Yeah,
I would assume so.
Who's running it? Is it a CBS show?
Yeah, it's going to be on CBS All Access.
I see. Yeah,
exactly.
And they've said that with what they're shooting for, because there's several other Star Trek franchise shows that are in the works. Mm-hmm. They want to get everything up and running so that there's a fresh season of something in the Star Trek franchise happening all year round.
Yeah, because they need that for their nonsense one franchise story of the subscription service.
Yeah, so basically what they're doing is ultimately setting it up so if you want to watch all the Star Trek shows, you have to always have a CBS All Access subscription, unlike what I'm doing, where I sign up for a month when Discovery was almost finished, watched everything, and then canceled my subscription.
Yep.
Apparently this is my fault. I'm sorry.
Well, no, you know what's good is, but you could just do that. You could binge, right? Now you're just going to have more stuff to binge within a given month, and you just do it four times a year, right? You'll do 4 months, and then you have a quarter to watch, like, not a quarter, but you can watch them all and catch up for that quarter and do another month, and you could do it for one quarter of the price. Hopefully, they'll get enough feedback. I hope people do exactly what you did, Jeff, where they just do it and binge in a month and finish with it. And they can incorporate that into the pricing and make it so that we don't have to play this game and can just pay them a fair price for this moving forward.
That'd be nice.
I would love that.
It'd be nice.
Yeah.
All right. So there we have it. Sorry for going long, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was really fun.
That was a lot of fun. Yeah.
Thanks to Simple Contacts for being our sponsor.
Yes, head over to their website, simplecontacts.com/ACM, and get $20 off your first order. And if you forget to use the URL, you can still use the discount code ACM at checkout to get that discount.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And we appreciate them sponsoring us very, very much. And I think we have a show.
I think we do. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write us at acm@macobserver.com, and thanks for listening.
Our content is written by the good people of Observer. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO, and all from John Keat were directed at me, and that's all for this week.
And stay subscribed.
We'll see you online at the Mac Observer. Unless John catches me, which honestly is likely.
I'm going to go make more popcorn.